Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, April 13th. Today we hear from Congresswoman Jill Takuda following her most recent visit to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. Immigration arrests and detentions have skyrocketed in Hawaii under President Donald Trump's second administration. We learn more about who's being held behind bars. The recent storms have affected the tourism outlook for the state this year. We get the latest projections from the visitor industry. And a new magazine featuring native birds took flight at the Merry Monarch Festival over the weekend. We learn more about the art of photographing our endemic forest species. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we turn our attention to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. It's where dozens of immigrants are currently being held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's hard to know what's happening inside the facility, but on Friday, Congresswoman Jill Takuda made her fourth visit to try and find out more about who's been detained and why. On this trip, she was able to bring a translator to talk directly with the detainees. They are from places in Europe, Asia, and Central and South America, but Takuda says the vast majority built lives in Hawaii prior to being detained. The big change is that immigrants are now being held separately from the general inmate population of those accused of committing federal crimes. Takuda spoke with HBR's Ashley Mizuo about what she saw inside.
So we're here at the Federal Detention Center, where all of the ICE detainees that are picked up through the islands are brought, both men and women. You know, I've been coming here multiple times since this Trump administration started, and we've seen way more folks coming here than ever before. I was here in January, as you know, and I spent over 4 hours here talking to almost two dozen individuals. I came here today, spoke with probably close to 10, almost a dozen folks, men and women, who came and shared their stories, had different issues, are in different places in terms of their cases, and we do everything that we can to assist them. In some cases, I was really grateful. I had a member of my staff that could actually help me translate this time, because I can't actually bring a mobile translator, let's say, in to be able to talk with them. But it is heartbreaking to hear them share their stories. I have mothers who are separated from their children, crying in front of me, talking how they did everything they could to volunteer at their schools, part of their halaus, and they know right now that their children are hurting. They see them once in a while, but it's painful when they leave here.
What was it like in there? Can you like kind of describe, you know, what the conditions are for people? What do you see when you're in there?
Yeah. The conditions compared to a lot of other places across the continent are good in the sense that they're conditioned. Each person has an individual cell to themselves. You know, they've got hot food. What I will say is this, you really, when you spend time in there, you realize there's no daylight. There's small windows. You can't see outside. I couldn't tell you if it was pouring rain outside or a bright sunny day sometimes. And so the fact that you don't have fresh air, that you do have exercise rooms that are available to them, which is great, but you're looking at light through barred windows. So there's an emotional, mental factor involved in that. What's really difficult too is just hearing the stories. There's a lot of mental anguish going on. I spoke with a woman who separated her from her husband. He's in here too. She said she can see him once every 3 months. They've been here for almost a year.
So is it separated by gender? How does it?
Separated by gender. So there is a male unit and a female unit. But this married couple, for example, came here together from Guam. They actually have working, you know, visas. They have social security numbers. They did nothing wrong except sought to seek asylum in the United States. And right now, you know, she's struggling. She said, he's been my life. We've been married for 17 years, and I just want to be able to know he's okay. So there was a lot of tough things to hear and see. There are folks that have struggled with violence outside of these walls. They were trying to escape it, and now they're finding prison instead. And so my focus is getting in here as often as we can to help make sure we're both a voice, but an advocate, so they can get some help and support. Many are connected with legal services, but translation is a basic issue that they are facing. They cannot communicate with folks even on the inside. And so oftentimes we find ourselves, you know, making sure they have access to medical care because they need help. They have access to religious books that they need, you know, dietary restrictions based upon their religion, all these different things. Language can be a barrier. And we want to make sure that you know, we overcome something as simple as that at times. But even just listening to their stories, we know that's something that's really important for them to be heard.
Can you tell me about, like, when you're in there, like, what are some of, like, the demographics of people? Like, are there more men than women?
More men than women. That has been the trend. I've seen the numbers go up and down over the past 16 to 18 months, but definitely more men than women. You have folks from everywhere. You have folks from the UK and Ireland and Russia. You have folks from, you know, Micronesia. You have folks from China, Vietnam that I've seen. Today, you have folks from Venezuela and Mexico as well. It runs the gamut in terms of individuals, where they came from. One consistent thing is, for a vast majority of the folks that I've talked to, they had a life here in Hawaii. They were working. They were contributing to society. They were part of churches. They were a part of schools. Many of them have families that are still here. Children that are United States citizens, spouses that are waiting for them. And so it is, it's life's disrupted. And if you ask me, are these the worst of the worst, the absolute criminals that we've heard the Trump administration talk about wanting to get out of our society? That is not what I'm seeing here. A few, yes, made mistakes decades ago, served time, you know, we're back in the community, working hard. Some, the record, the offense they had was coming to this country trying to find a legal path to citizenship. That was it for many of them. So it's really something to actually come here and hold their hands, talk to them, and just come back out here knowing we've got to work with so many organizations that have been fighting for them, but we've got to fight to help them.
And I understand that now people who are in immigration detention are separated from people who are being held here on criminal charges or criminal offenses.
Yeah. So that's a good thing now, because the Big Ugly Bill gave ICE, CBP, such a flush of money, as we know, over $1 billion. They were able to create separate units so that there's now a separate female and male wards for ICE detainees specifically. Whereas when I first started coming here, they were mixed with federal criminals here. So that was not a good situation at all. They are completely separate. Their meals are made in separate facilities. They don't cross paths at any particular point in time, never even when showering or visiting. They are all completely separate. Even today when we went in there, females and males were separated. I could not see female ICE detainees at the same time I was seeing male detainees. So they brought them in separate, you know, groups. But there is absolute separation between the two.
Let's get back to HPR's conversation with Congresswoman Jill Takuda. On Friday, she visited the Federal Detention Center in Honolulu to hear directly from immigrants who are being held. She was able to bring a translator in, and she spoke with almost a dozen men and women being held there at the facility. HPR's Ashley Mizzou asked Takuda about whether her office has fielded more calls from immigrants since the start of the second Trump administration and what changes she's seen inside.
Well, you know, I would tell you there's a lot of people that are even just scared to call a federal office. So even calling our office for help for a loved one who's in there can be very intimidating to folks. But we have had people calling our office saying, my husband is in there, my son is in there, you know, needing help, knowing I was going to be there, right, and reaching out. So we do have constituents. These are American citizens, in many cases, calling on behalf of loved ones and friends that are in here. So our office has been doing that work. And as I said, probably easily once a quarter, if not more, we've been going in there just to make sure we can connect with people, know their status. In some cases, folks I met with last time have already been deported. In some cases, they've been released back to the community because their case was really solid. And they're awaiting some final decisions, you know, in the community. It's a constantly changing situation, but we do encourage people, if they need help, please reach out to our office.
How often is it that people are you continue to see the same people here? Like, are they being held for like months at a time?
We've got folks in here, and I couldn't see all of them today, that have been here since the last time I was here, and they were here before as well. So as I said, there's folks that have been here almost a year, if not over a year as well. And many in some of these cases are just telling me, we want to self-deport, or we just want to go back, let us out. And that was the case last time, and we know for many of those, they have been deported. I hope really deported, because in a few cases we know they actually were deported to other detention centers on the continent instead. So I think the real goal is to try to be as humane as possible through what has really been an inhumane process of extraction. Literally, people ripped up from their doorsteps and their lives and their families and put in here with limited ability to communicate or contact. As I said, if you met and talked to some of these folks, chances are you've seen them before. They've served your food. They've cleaned your yard. They've built your walls. They've been in your churches with you. They went to school. Their kids went to school with your kids. I know there's this image of who these people are, but when I go in there, there are a lot of citizens, just regular people that were trying to do right. In many cases, we're working through that legal pathway, were unable to obtain it, and now find themselves in detention.
What are people's kind of like day-to-day like here? Like, are they able to like go out, like, are they going outside? Like, what?
For the people that have been here, and I can't imagine 11 months, you don't get the sky. You get the sky through slivered windows. Take a look at the building. Those windows are what they see out of. And there might be a little skylight in the rec room on a different angle, but nothing that's low enough that you could see out of it to know what your surroundings are, what the weather necessarily might be like. You can tell it's getting gray. You might be able to see water coming down. But one woman in there expressed to me, she goes, I don't know what day it is anymore. I don't remember when I came in here because I've just been in here, right? And so we have to think about, they don't get fresh air like this. It is very comfortable. I will give you that compared to a lot of the conditions we've heard about on the continent, where it's extremely hot and humid and unsanitary. It's very clean in there. Very good air conditioning, to the point it's actually really cold in there. You know, they have food and, you know, they have the ability to have a private, you know, cell, just one person, not any bunk mates and things. But many have said, I have not seen the sky. I don't know when it was that I got here, or when I had my case, or when I lost out, you know, a loved one.
Right, because it's still detention.
It is still detention, and if you think about it, it is still a federal prison. That is a situation they're in. You know, if you think about even some of our prisons here in Hawaii, they have the ability to go into the yard, get outside, get some fresh air, right? There is a physical gym in there for each one, a workout area, but they don't get to see any of this or breathe any of this right now. And for some, they haven't done that in months and months, almost a year.
How have you seen the Honolulu Federal Detention Center regarding the immigration detention change over the times that you've come? I know one of them is obviously the separation from the people, right, with criminal charges, but you know, what are some of the other things that you've seen evolve or change for good or bad at the facility?
Yeah, well, you know, I would just say this, they have been very good to us, you know, accommodating to allow me to come in as well. So I do appreciate that. We've heard good things generally from the detainees about how they are treated as well. But I also do know that they have to answer to the top. And this is not an administration, again, that is looking to try to find some humanity or compassion in what has been an absolute inhumane attack on a lot of people.
Have you seen any changes when it comes to the new leadership for Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen?
I have not seen anything yet. Perhaps we will. When we come out of days like this, we have a slew of questions, a slew of requests that we have to make. Perhaps we might see whether or not the answers come back quick enough, whether they are positive or if they're kind of reined in. I mean, I haven't seen any changes yet with a new secretary in place. But again, I think we view our job as just making sure there's some humanity in there, and people aren't asking for a lot. Literally have a lady, she needs to be able to see a doctor and speak a language she understands. So the ability to communicate that I'm not well, it sounds like something so basic, right? But sometimes these are difficult things when, again, you're in a prison situation. You're in a detention situation. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of anxiety and intimidation. We're just trying to help folks that prior to being in here are probably helping us.
And then last one, because I know we're getting totally rained on, is, you know, you mentioned, so you said that you leave with like a bunch of questions. You know, like, what are some of these outstanding things that you want answers that you haven't received answers for yet?
Follow up on their cases, when actually they will be deported. In some cases, can they talk to their dying mother? Can they get a video call with her before she passes? And it's already been denied once, and I want to make sure she gets that one last call with her mother. can I see my husband a little bit more frequently than once every 3 months when he's literally in the floor above me right now? Can I get access to medical care and with the language that I speak because I'm not well? A religious textbook that took 7 months early to get to, making sure this another religious textbook in their language doesn't take 7 months as well. Those are the kind of questions that I have.
That was Congresswoman Jill Takuda talking about her recent visit to the Federal Detention Center to hear from immigrants who are being held at the facility. You know, the forecast for Hawaii tourism this year is for modest growth. Honolulu Star Advertiser's Allison Schaefer joins us live this morning to talk about the challenges ahead. She has an article in the paper this morning. The impact of the war in Iran on fuel charges, surcharges and fees looms large, and the headlines about the weather aren't helping either. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Gosh, now you were down at the Capitol on Friday for Tourism Day. What was that like, you know, knowing what we're dealing with the weather?
Well, the Capitol Day almost didn't happen because of the weather. It came down to the wire. So I think weather was top of mind for everybody, especially given all the other challenges that we're already dealing with. And, you know, you mentioned the war, the rising costs, the fuel costs, the growing uncertainty, you know, tied to global tensions or just global relations in general. And then the disruptive weather, you know, hasn't helped.
I saw something about how Canada was warning its citizens about traveling to Hawaii because of the bad weather. And I was like, yikes, you know, not everybody is flooded.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big issues. They did that on April 8th. And I mean, just to be clear, Canada was already down about 16% for Hawaii. It's down 25% for the U.S. as a whole. So we were doing a little better. But 16% is a big loss for our second largest international market. And, you know, that really is kind of the story of tourism in that, you know, we're showing only slow gains going into all this from U.S. mainland travelers. And, you know, we're continuing, that's been offset by weakening international demand. So it doesn't help when your second largest market has an advisory against that. I think one of the big topics, you know, is that they need some sort of a recovery campaign, not just for the floods, but all the other things that the floods have just put the exclamation point on. But it's the timing of that, you know, when do you do it and how do you do it with limited resources?
And they don't have that flexibility like they did before, or now that it's a, you know, an agency under the Department of Business and Economic Development and Tourism.
That's right. Department of DBET is very supportive of some sort of a recovery campaign, but HTA lost its dedicated tourism special fund in 2022. And because of that, they're funded through the general fund, and there are program IDs on everything in that budget. So it's hard to move funds around for an emergency. That really probably takes permission to use the reserve funds. So they're planning a $2 million campaign to kind of address the flooding as well as some of these other things statewide, but certainly on the North Shore of Oahu, where business has just been decimated in the aftermath of these continuing floods.
Yes, I've heard, you know, some small businesses complain that there's just no business. It's not like, you know, that whole half of the island is closed. I mean, you know, it's a tough situation to be in.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, it's not just the floods, it's the repair work and the traffic advisories around that. And then it's, you know, that people don't understand geography, but I've been over to the North Shore since, and I would say for most businesses, traffic is down about 70% because, you know, the tourism market is hugely down, and the local market, people have, they're trying to rebuild their places. They don't have the funds to go out to eat necessarily or to do the activities. And if you're a water activity, you know, with the brown water advisories that have been into effect so often, and concern over that, you're probably 100% down. So It was really eerie to be there and be in restaurant, you know, visiting restaurants where there's not a single person in the restaurant. That's hard to see.
Yeah, and I learned that there was a change in the cruise ship schedule. You know, I think a ship that was supposed to come in Friday to Honolulu got shifted to Hilo, and then it was able to come in yesterday. But yeah, lots of maneuvering, and then yeah, how do you respond if you're a small business?
Well, and these cruise ship schedules, small businesses schedule for them. They do staffing based on that and everything else. And there are a huge amount of small businesses that rely very heavily on that cruise ship traffic to, you know, make or break the month. So, you know, that's really difficult for the businesses as we go forward.
Yeah, it's a complicated picture, very nuanced, and I can understand why HTA would want some flexibility to be able to respond to this messaging.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think one of the issues now is their current budget, which is in the base budget of the general fund, is $63 million. But like in 2018, their budget was $82 million, and it was just marketing. They didn't have to do destination stewardship, too, and it wasn't based on, you know, the emergency stuff as well. So they're looking at, you know, really probably less than half of what they once had when you subtract all of that out. And, you know, efforts to restore the budget. There was one that crossed over and went fairly far, but it died in WAM this year. It would have given them a percentage of the TAT closer to what they were before. So yeah, times are tough. It's lean everywhere, and there's a lot of competing interests. So trying to get that money from a state that's struggling, it's rough.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for tracking this. We have been talking with Honolulu Star Advertiser's Allison Schaffers. Check out her story online at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving Hawaii and supporting local businesses, including collaborations spotlighting local creators. Upcoming collabs at shop.zippies.com.
You know, we're just coming off the Merry Monarch Festival, and we're hearing that a new magazine flew off the tables at the craft fair. It's titled Manu, Hawaiian Forest Birds, and it spotlights native honey creepers like the i'iwi, as well as our beloved owl, the pueo, and the Hawaiian hawk, the io. By day, Brian Shiroda is a pilot for Hawaiian Airlines, but off the clock, Shiroda has developed a real talent for wildlife photography. Shiroda recalls a project that spurred his interest, designing worksheets for Keiki as part of his job as a pilot. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about what happened next.
One of the things I really appreciate about Hawaiian Airlines is being able to infuse some Hawaiian culture into the way we run business. And one of the things that they do is name the airplanes after native birds. So I thought, well, it would be a cool idea to feature a bird on this little worksheet and, you know, have a little picture of it. But I scoured the internet, and, you know, once you start finding photos that are copyrighted, you know, to be very careful. I don't want to infringe on anyone's copyright. And so I thought, okay, well, how hard could this be? Let me grab my camera and just, you know, find out where I can, you know, hit the trails and look for some birds myself. And long story short, I turned up empty-handed. I'm like walking through the forest. I have no idea what I'm listening to. Every little movement in the bush or, you know, through the leaves, I just didn't know what I was looking at. You know, was this native? Was this non-native? So that was kind of the beginning of my adventure into bird photography. And it's kind of like Pokemon, you know, you gotta catch them all. So once you get your spark bird, you know, it just kind of leads to, okay, well, I got this species, now I need this species. And then not just the species, but also the type of plant that you'll find them on, the different types of native plants. So
yeah. I love the worksheet you were creating. Yeah. And this question of how hard could it be?
Right.
But when people take a look at this zine that you've created, they will see birds so lifelike, so well posed. It's as if you asked them to sit for a portrait.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of exposure to the birds. So, I mean, there are days when I get out there and I'm not able to get the shot. In fact, the birds don't even show up, you know. So I take every encounter with the birds as something to learn from. So sometimes I get the shot, sometimes I don't. But it does take a lot of observation, so listening, And then also looking for, you know, movement, whether it's in flying overhead or in certain types of native plants. So just knowing where to look for them. And, you know, sometimes honey creepers especially will trap line feed. So they'll come back to the same flower if they're nectar feeding. And they'll come back over and over and repeat visits. Not always, but, you know, sometimes they do. And I will always note the time that I see them. So usually it'll be about 15 to 20 minutes, sometimes a little bit longer. But if you're patient enough, there will be a repeat visit. And not just a repeat visit, but oftentimes the bird will perch and approach the flower in the same exact pose or position. Sometimes the flower is well placed and sometimes they're a bit difficult to get a clear shot. But it all comes down to patience and anticipating how that bird might approach a flower or perch for you.
So you're learning about the bird's behavior.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
As you're photographing it. Oh, yeah. I mean, that you must have learned a lot about how certain species behave.
Right.
And
right.
Even how certain individual birds behave.
Right. So I have a home library. I basically bought every book on native Hawaiian birds that I could find. I mean, I scoured eBay, Amazon, out of print books. That's, yeah, that's basically how I learned a lot. But not just reading, but I also became connected with people who work in conservation. So biologists who work for the state of Hawaii, you know, some big names like Brett Mossman and Alex Wong and Jack Jeffrey from Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge. And, you know, I credit the many mentors that I've met along the way that really helped to inspire, you know, the types of photos that I capture. And they, you know, they'll clue me into, oh, you know, well, did you know that, you know, this particular species will sometimes do this? You know, that's kind of a very unique behavior if you can capture that. And that's something I might actually go and look for. And, you know, like if I happen to get that captured on camera, I'm just super excited, you know, to reach out to them. Like, oh my God, you'll never know what I just saw, you know. And then just sharing the excitement of being able to document some of the rarest behaviors that I'm fortunate to witness from some of the rarest birds that we have left in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look inside this zine.
Sure.
What page do you want to go to? What bird would you like to show us?
I mean, you said you were going to ask me what my favorite bird to photograph was, and it would be the Akeapola owl, which is found only on Hawaii Island. And it is an endangered species, a very fascinating bird to observe out in the wild. And it can be challenging to photograph due to their erratic behavior, you know, their foraging styles, much like a woodpecker. So a lot of times in the forest, you know, I'm working in very low light conditions, and you know, in order to capture a portrait or a, you know, mid action shot, I need a shutter speed that can freeze the frame without being too grainy or noisy in exposure. And yeah, just a very fascinating bird, and I've learned a lot photographing this particular species.
Well, describe a few of these images to our listeners, because you have the classic bird perched on a branch, but you also have the Akeapola owl in motion, opening its mouth.
Oh, yes. So that photo, we were fortunate. I was with Jack Jeffrey at the time at Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, and we came across a male Akeapola owl that was very low at eye level, and just on the edge of some dense foliage on a rotting koa log. And this male was just working his way down the branch and removing chunks of bark. So they're insectivores, and he's looking for grubs or larvae, insects, anything that might be hiding beneath the bark. And in that photo, he's actually chucking away a chunk of bark as he just totally demolished that log. So that was a fascinating encounter. One of the most memorable I've had, actually.
What do you hope that listeners and viewers will take away from this zine?
So this zine, one of the main themes that I really wanted to push is the relationships between native Hawaiian forest birds and the native forests. So you can't have one without the other. They really depend on each other. I really want them to notice how many times ohia trees show up in the photos, or even koa. And I'd like that to help influence maybe some of this discussions or actions that they could do to help conservation for the birds, whether it's, you know, stop feeding the feral pigs on the side of the road, or keeping cats indoors, removing mosquito breeding grounds by eliminating standing water, rapid ohia death, spraying our equipment and boots with at least 70% alcohol, and cleaning our gear before we travel to different, from one forest to another.
It's become almost a famous image now of an EEV with a mosquito next to its eye to demonstrate the impact of avian malaria. And I think there's so much value in images like those that share firsthand what we as humans have been doing to our forests through introduced species and deforestation. But I also think, and your zine shows this, that there can be so much value and joy in showing the forest at its best, showing these species where there ought to be existing and doing their thing.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of times when I tell people that I'm into bird photography, they just kind of look at me and I can tell what they're thinking, right? Like, oh gosh, this guy is, he's a bird nerd, you know, until I actually show them some of my photography and they're like, whoa, you took that? Like, yeah. And where did you find that? Well, you have to go to the high upland forest and you have to know where to look. And I think that really surprises people that you can still find these honeycreepers and, you know, different bird species, native birds up in the native forest. They're still there. Hawaii is the extinction capital of the world. Unfortunately, we are looking at possibly losing a few more species in the next few years. So Kauai hasn't been doing so well with native forest birds due to mosquito-borne diseases. And there are similar challenges on the island of Maui. Hawaii Island is fortunate enough to have forests that are high enough to escape the mosquito line. But, you know, I just want people to know that these birds are still there, and hopefully we can appreciate them and also do things that or action that might help them in the future.
That was Brian Shiroda and HPR's Maddie Bender. Shiroda's zine is titled Manu, Hawaiian Forest Birds. It sold out its first run, but Shiroda expects to have more copies of the magazine available later this week. It'll also be available at the Heart of Honolulu Street Festival coming up on May 9th. Well, that does it for us today. Thank you for spending time with us on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Now back to the pitch table.